you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the "no animals were harmed" message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
Content warning: this episode contains discussion of murder, including the murder of a child.
One of the first true crime stories that really made an impact on me was the 1982 Chicago Tylenol murders. Seven people in that city died from taking Tylenol that had been laced with cyanide. It seemed terrifying that innocent people could pass away so horribly by doing something as normal as taking a pain reliever. And somehow, the very worst part of it was that the person who did it never got prosecuted for those deaths.
But maybe that will change. Award-winning Chicago Tribune investigative reporters Christy Gutowski and Stacy St. Clair learned that this case is far from cold, that law enforcement is still working on solving it. They reported on the case and the current investigation in a series of terrific articles in the Tribune, and also in their podcast, Unsealed. We recently got a chance to talk to them about the case. My name is Anya Kane. I'm a journalist.
And I'm Kevin Greenlee. I'm an attorney.
We first connected while looking into the Burger Chef murders, an Indiana cold case. Together, we built a spreadsheet documenting hundreds of cases of restaurant-related homicides. That original spreadsheet gave way to our podcast, The Murder Sheet.
Now we maintain that same research-centric, investigative approach as we look into all sorts of homicides, including unsolved cases, historical crimes, and, of course, restaurant murders.
We don't just chat about the headlines. Our podcast is a platform for our journalism. The Murder Sheet focuses on investigative reporting, thoughtful analysis, thorough research, and in-depth interviews.
We're The Murder Sheet, and this is The Tylenol Murders, a conversation with Unsealed's Christy Gutowski and Stacy St. Clair.
Can you tell us a little bit about your backgrounds and how you got involved in this case?
Sure. My name is Christy Gutowski. I'm a reporter for the Chicago Tribune. I started in 2010, and I'm a lifelong Chicagoan, born and raised in South Suburbs. And Stacy and I actually met in the 90s. We were both reporters for the third largest newspaper in Illinois called the Daily Herald. It's mostly based in the suburbs. And obviously the Tylenol murders were based largely in the suburbs. So we began writing about some of the twists and turns in this case early in our careers. And I actually was a courthouse reporter in DuPage County for a decade and got to know a lot of the detectives who had been part of Tylenol Task Force One. They were at the twilight of their career, working the second job as investigators for the state's attorney's office. And it just always stuck with me how this case, they never let it go. And it really haunted some of them that they were never able to solve it.
My name is Stacy St. Clair, and I am a reporter with the Chicago Tribune. And, you know, I've spent my entire professional career working beside Christy at two newspapers now. And like she said, this is a case that if you are a reporter in the Chicago area, it has crossed your desk at one point or another, because there have been so many starts and stops to the case and twists and turns. So I'm no different. It's crossed my desk a couple of times. And with the 40th anniversary, our editors asked us to take a look at it. We thought we were going to be writing about a cold case, and it turned out it was a lot hotter than we thought.
Yeah, we'd just gotten off the Kyle Rittenhouse trial in Kenosha late last year, and we were both just exhausted and wanted something different. And when an editor suggested, you know, the 40-year anniversary is coming up, we talked about it and thought, well, this could be fun and interesting. And it seemed like the timing, it just seems like time's running out. 40 years is such a long time, but right away we found out that, you know, people had died or witnesses had moved away, memories fade, and we just thought this was a pivotal time. The main suspect, James Lewis, is 76, so it just seemed like now or never.
I'd love to go back to the very beginning. Of course, before you can solve a crime, you have to be aware that a crime has actually happened. Can you tell us about the original deaths in this case back in 82? And the process by which people figured out that it was the result of a crime?
Sure. So the deaths began on the morning of September 29th, 1982, when 12-year-old Mary Kellerman woke up and wasn't feeling well. Her father told her she could stay home from school. And while he was downstairs calling the school bus to say she wouldn't be on that day, she went into the bathroom and took a single extra strength Tylenol. She collapsed and was pronounced dead before her classmates had really dug into their classes that day. And several hours later, in a town about 8 miles away, Adam Janis was home from his day off. He was his day off from work. And he too was feeling good enough to run some errands, but not great. So he took a couple Tylenol, and he was found unresponsive by his wife, who summoned help. And he was taken to the hospital in Arlington Heights, where really the medical mystery surrounding this case began. And so what happened was Adam's family, they're a family of Polish immigrants in the Chicago area. We have a very large Polish immigrant population in Chicago. Family rushed to the hospital. The doctors primarily spoke with his brother-in-law and his brother, Stanley, and his sister-in-law, Terry, because they spoke English, explained what happened. The entire family then went back to Adam Janis's house to be with his wife and children and start playing the funeral. And that's when Stanley, Adam's brother, and his sister-in-law, Terry, took Tylenol at the house. You can imagine, right? They're grieving, they have the headaches that come with grief. and they go into the bathroom, they take Tylenol, and then they collapse. And it's those firefighters who respond to Terry and Stanley's emergency call who had also responded to Adam's, and they very quickly look at each other and say, this isn't heart attacks, right? That's what they dismissed Adam Janice's death as, a heart attack. Guys, this isn't heart attacks. This is something else.
There was also a public health nurse at the hospital named Helen Jensen, who really is key to helping solve this medical mystery. Her, and then there was a doctor, Dr. Thomas Kim, who put it together along with some Cook County Medical Examiner officials as well. And that 24-hour period and really stemmed, stopped more deaths from occurring. So we had four deaths at this point. Well, one of the victims was put on life support, so she didn't die within that first 24-hour period. But over in DuPage County, a neighboring county from Cook County, we had two single mothers die in that same 24-hour period. Tragically, one of the mothers had just delivered her fourth child days earlier, and just had the aches and pains from childbirth and took some Tylenol. And each one of the victims had the same physical symptoms. Their eyes were fixed and dilated, their breathing shallow, as if being suffocated by some invisible force. All of them were young. Mary Kellerman was 12, the oldest victim was 35, and in relatively good health. Another victim was Mary McFarlane in Elmhurst. She died she was stricken at work. She was working at a phone center in the suburbs in Lombard. And she, just from dealing with the public and customers, she had taken a couple of Tylenol and also had those same symptoms. And lastly, there was one victim from Chicago, and she wasn't found. This was on a Wednesday. She wasn't found until that Friday, and that was Paula Prince. She was a 35-year-old flight attendant, but they determined from the receipt from the Tylenol she had bought after she'd gotten back from a flight that she had bought it Wednesday and taken it. And literally, the cyanide is such a powerful poison that her body, she was in the bathroom, she had a cotton ball, taking off her makeup from a long day's work, and she literally just fell backwards, and half her body was in the bathroom, half was in the hallway, and died. And she was found on Friday.
So what really tied it all together were the Janices, because Helen Jensen, who Christy mentioned, the public health nurse, she interviewed Adam Janice's wife to see what would happen that day, right? How did three young, healthy people, all from the same family, end up dead? And in her interview, she determined that they all had Tylenol. Adam's wife mentioned all of them taking the Tylenol. So Helen had this theory that it had to be the Tylenol that tied them together. At the same time as she was interviewing Adam Janice's widow, a firefighter named Chuck Kramer was listening to the conversation. He's in quarantine because they didn't know what was going on, right? They thought it could be like an environmental toxin. They thought it could be some kind of airborne illness. So he's in quarantine with all these other people. They get released because they figure out it's probably not, some kind of airborne illness. And he's on his way back to the station, and he calls in that his crew is going to be out of commission for decontamination. And he gets a phone call from an off-duty firefighter saying, what is going on? And he tells him, he says, we had a day you wouldn't believe. Three young, healthy people dropped dead, nothing tying their deaths together except they all took Tylenol. And that guy says, Tylenol? My mother-in-law works with a woman whose 12-year-old daughter died after taking Tylenol. And then the firefighters alert the proper authorities, and then it goes from there. And that helps them identify not only the Janices and Mary Kellerman as victims, but Mary Reiner, Mary Sue McFarlane, and Paula Prince all get identified as cyanide victims from these puzzle pieces that the Arlington Heights folks and Dr. Kim put together.
Can you speak to the reaction from not only law enforcement, but the public around Chicago as it becomes clear that these mysterious deaths are not only linked, but are related to, you know, cyanide, and there's a rash of poisonings happening right now. I imagine the horror, I guess, if you could speak to that.
It was a much more innocent time back in 1982. This was years later, they describe it as really one of the, if not the first, one of the first acts of domestic terrorism. This was a time when you could go into a grocery store and open a carton of milk or a jar of peanut butter, and there'd be no protection, or Tylenol, there'd be no safety, protection. All there was basically a cotton ball. So you can imagine it was absolute hysteria. And, you know, we interviewed people, police officers, the victims' families and others who described cops going, this is a pre-internet world, going down block by block with a bullhorn, urging people to not to take their Tylenol, to throw out their Tylenol, to turn in their Tylenol to local police departments. So it was hysteria. And this was right before Halloween. So a lot of us, I was 13 at the time, I'm old enough to remember that Halloween was something was, you know, different about it. So it became a national news story.
And I understand also that there are certain challenges in an investigation when you have victims in different jurisdictions. So how did they come together to figure out how to conduct this investigation?
Sure. And that is a really good way to describe it. Each victim, with the exception of the Janices, lived in different towns. So there's a police department in each of those towns who's investigating, and they happen in two different counties. So there are prosecutors in these two different counties who will make the ultimate decision whether to charge. So they had different chains of command. So, and things were kind of all over the place. So what they did was they tapped the Illinois Attorney General, who actually had no jurisdiction. Attorneys Generals in Illinois do not investigate crimes. Or do not investigate violent crimes. They tapped our Illinois Attorney General at the time, whose name was Ty Fainer. He was a really outstanding federal prosecutor who had experience working with multi-agency task force. So they thought like he would be the best to sort of spearhead the thing. And then President Reagan was concerned. It was causing a nationwide panic. So he ordered the FBI into the case. The only problem was the FBI had no jurisdiction, because at the time, tampering with a consumer product like that was not a federal offense. Now it is now, and that's part of Tylenol's legacy. But at the time, there was no jurisdiction for the FBI. So they found a misdemeanor law on the books involving truth in labeling. And so their theory, which they all admit, all the former FBI agents admit, it was preposterous. That they, you know, they're in on it too. They know it's not an authentic or legitimate reason, but their reason for getting in was that they had to investigate whether Johnson & Johnson knew cyanide was in those pills and then didn't put it on the label. So with that sort of, you know, hook and a crook, as they described it in our story, the FBI entered the Tylenol task force. And obviously when Paula Prince was found on October 1st, CPD joined, and that's when things got a little tense.
At The Murder Sheet, we're all about immersive audio experiences.
That's why we love Audible. An Audible subscription gives you access to thousands of audiobook titles. We especially enjoy their robust selection of mysteries, thrillers, and true crime.
I love Audible. I've really enjoyed listening to A Wicked Snow by Greg Olson. This story is all about a CSI investigator with a dark past and a terrible family secret. When I'm listening to Audible, it plunks me right down in the middle of the story. It's so spine-tingling that I can practically feel the cold air on my skin. Audible is your one-stop destination for thrillers and mysteries. Just be prepared to get spooked in the best possible way.
Listening to audiobooks offers a wonderful respite from the day. Audible allows you to listen on the go. I love taking a walk or a drive and just getting lost in a story. My favorite audiobook on Audible so far is Presumed Innocent, the book track edition. This classic legal thriller by Scott Turow is enhanced by a gripping musical soundtrack that amplifies the story's suspense and profound emotional beats.
As a new member, you can try out Audible for free for 30 days. This is such a valuable membership, and you get access to so many new listening experiences, including podcasts, Audible originals, and Audible exclusives, like the Words Plus Music series.
Visit audible.com/msheet or text msheet to 500-500.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you can speak to some of that tension when you have a task force with, you know, the feds and local police and city police coming together. You know, you get an abundance of resources, but you also get perhaps different opinions and different methods. So if you could speak to that.
We talk about it in our Chicago Tribune newspaper series, as well as the podcast, that turf wars. Everyone wanted their name on the marquee. Everyone wanted to be the one to solve it. Everyone wanted that lead that ended up, figuring out this mystery of what kind of a madman could do something like this. So one thing they did that was kind of ingenious at the time was the task force was organized in teams. So one member of the FBI, one member of the state police, and then a suburban police officer were teamed together daily. And they, you know, go to the task force meeting in the morning, and they'd get updates and they'd get leads, and then they'd go out together. So that seemed to, from our reporting, we found it worked well. But then once Chicago Police Department got involved, there was a lot more friction, especially when Chicago Police developed their own suspect in early October. They wanted to, Paula Prince was their murder, that was their victim. They wanted to be the ones to investigate it. They didn't like having to drive out to Des Plaines, which was a good, 45 minutes without traffic, double that with Chicago traffic every day. And there was also an interesting time dynamic at that time between the FBI and Chicago police, because there was an infamous case known as the Marquette 10 at the time, where 10 Chicago police officers were indicted for basically shaking down drug dealers. And it was an FBI federal investigation. So, they didn't go into Tylenol to the task force and to the investigation with the best relationship to begin with.
One thing I found interesting reading the articles is that nowadays we hear a lot about FBI profiles and things of that nature. And apparently this is one of the first cases where profiles really played a part. And can you discuss that?
Yeah, so it was one of the earliest uses of it. And, I will say that investigators both in 1982 and today, there are some who find it, a little bit too broad, almost like a horoscope where you could make anything kind of fit. But, we talked to FBI agents who found it immensely helpful, and they helped sort of narrow down in the FBI's mind the person they were looking for, and that it would be somebody who had a traumatic childhood, had a history of abusing animals, had allegations of violence, in his past. They assumed it was a male, even though women are more likely to kill with poison. Women are more likely to kill someone they know, whereas a man is more likely to commit mass murder or kill perfect strangers. So, and then one of our favorite bits of the profile was that the person would soon grow bored of not getting enough attention, get bored with sort of the anonymity of the crime, and would sort of insert themselves into the case, a sort of, you know, one FBI agent described it to us as, enough about me talking about me, you talk about me for a while. And so when someone later on in the case did insert themselves and offer to help solve the crime, it totally, you know, perked the FBI's antennas up.
Important thing to remember as well about the profile was that it wasn't about a specific target or suspect at the time, because they really didn't have, when this profile was written, a main person, a suspect. It was just who would, what a general portrait of who this killer could be. And it had the sort of stuff that, you know, we're used to hearing about nowadays from all the, you know, shows that are out there, like cruel to animals, you know, history of violence, a loner, that sort of stuff. But one thing that was pretty specific was that, as Stacy mentioned, this person is enjoying all of this, you know, fervor that has grown from what they've done. And once the headlines die down and things get quiet, they're going to reach out. And the profiler said that they're going to identify with someone in law enforcement. And they actually described the person as someone who would wear a red tie and a blue suit and had gray hair. And that turned out to be pretty prophetic.
You mentioned the kind of the element of mass murder in this, and then the possibility, of course, in a consumer tampering case, that someone is a target and that the others are collateral to cover up who the target is. And of course, there's other scenarios that they were looking at, like post-manufacturing tampering versus factory contamination. Can you speak to some of those different possibilities and how they were either eliminated or considered over the course of the investigation?
Sure. So they did look at each victim individually to see if they had anyone in their orbit who would target them. Obviously, you look at family, coworkers, close friends, and that was done. And they didn't find anyone who was specifically could be targeted, in large part because the victims either bought the bottles themselves, or, you know, in Mary Kellerman's case, she's 12 years old, but her mother bought the bottle, right? So you have to start playing the odds. Like, if you want to target one of the victims, well, what are the odds that you're going to get them in the store, get them to pick the poisoned bottle off the shelf, you know, and then take it all within the same window? Like, the odds are very low, right, that would happen. Same with the production, because some of the pills were made in Texas and some of them came off a production line in Pennsylvania. So, and they never crossed paths. I mean, some of the bottles did, because some of, like, Mary Kellerman and Adam Janis came from the same lot, right? But not all the poison bottles that were found, including three that were found after the deaths, they were either pulled from the shelves or turned in. None of those bottles were all in the same place at the same time. So they said, you know, okay, so what are the odds that you, if you did it at the plant as they're coming off, what are the odds, even in both two separate places, what are the odds that they all end up in Chicago and are purchased in the same 24-hour period? So they just sort of mathematically eliminated a lot of the possibilities that way and said, it had to have taken place on the store shelves.
Also, they looked at disgruntled former employees of the grocery store chains where the tainted bottles had been purchased or were recovered in the recall. They did deep background checks on each one of the victims and their families. And actually, two of the spouses, one was a former spouse, did lie detector tests. And so there were, they looked at whether one of these people could have been targeted, Anya, like you asked, and they ruled that out.
Another thing that struck me about the investigation was the use of media. They actually reached out to the former Chicago Tribune columnist, Bob Green. Can you talk about that and the effect of that?
So I'll talk about one of the not so great moments in Tribune history on your podcast. So at one point, the profile suggested that the killer was enjoying the attention. So they had, with the profilers suggested, they go to Bob Green, who was a very popular Chicago Tribune columnist, and they asked him, with Mary Kellerman's parents' consent, to write a column that provided the address of Mary Kellerman's home and the location of her grave. And the column essentially was, if you're the killer, you know, you should drive by Mary Kellerman's parents' house and see the devastation you've caused them, or visit her grave and see the flowers that have been left for her. Sort of, you know, egging him on to show up at either of these places. And then they had surveillance at both of these places, hoping the killer would show up. It did not net any arrests or any good leads. But what it did do was, because the FBI planted it, it really upset their suburban detective, who the FBI was partnered with on Mary Kellerman's death, because he was completely blindsided. And then it goes back to the idea of tension among the various agencies that we talked about earlier.
And that's just one example of the out-of-the-box thinking that Task Force One did at that time. You know, this is before DNA and the CSI world that we live in. You know, nowadays you've got your, you know, you can't go to the grocery store without being captured and photographed, a dozen times. But back then, you know, they didn't have that. So there was a lot of different things that Stacey and I dug up that they did back then that really was out-of-the-box thinking. Like we interviewed Gray Steed, a former retired FBI agent, who talked about how they went to their counterparts in counterintelligence and, you know, reached out to the Soviets to find out if the Soviets had their satellites focused in on any of these stores where the 8 tainted bottles had come from, to see if, you know, if there, was there a chance that they actually caught the killer in the act. And unfortunately, the satellites weren't trained on any of those areas at the time, but they did, they set up time-lapse cameras at the grave sites of the seven victims and things like that, that, you know, seemed to us to be pretty forward thinking for the era.
And they even went to libraries, right? And looked up, who had checked out books on cyanide.
And veterinarians to see if anyone had practiced on animals first. And they looked at, suspicious deaths in the two county area, Cook and DuPage, for 2 years leading up to it, to see if maybe there were more than seven victims. So, yeah, they did a lot of needle in a haystack kind of investigative work.
I wanted to jump into some of the suspects that came on, throughout this, one, Roger Arnold. And I was wondering if you could speak to him and, tell us, why were police interested in him?
Roger Arnold was a Chicago man. And in 1982, he was a bit down on his luck and despondent. He was going through a divorce. He actually had all of these different similarities or coincidence to the crime. For example, he was a dock hand at one of the grocery chains where two of the eight tainted bottles came from. He had lived in the area. He drank. He was drinking a lot at the time because he was going through problems. He drank in the area where, near walking distance from where Paula Prince, the Walgreens, where she bought her bottle, and had lived, and worked. At one point he worked with the father of one of the victims, Mary Reiner. So he had all these different coincidences. So in early October, a owner of a bar on Lincoln Avenue in Chicago calls the Chicago Police Department and drops the dime on Roger Arnold. Says, listen, I've got this semi-regular who comes in here, and he was talking about having cyanide in his house, bragging. He's kind of like an amateur home chemist, and he was bragging about having cyanide, and he thought that was suspicious, so he called the police. So the police thought it was suspicious as well, and they picked up Arnold. They interviewed him. Arnold agreed, told them all about his life. He'd been adopted. He was a seventh grade dropout, didn't have a violent criminal history or anything like that, but he admitted to having cyanide in his home at one point, said he bought it from a mail order Wisconsin company, and that he had gotten rid of it because his ex-wife didn't like having it in the house, and he really didn't want any trouble. So he agreed to let them search his home, and they, without having to have a search warrant, and they went and they found all sorts of bizarre things, like James Bond's, what was the name of the book, Stacey? James Bond. The Poor Man's James Bond, and beakers and vials and how-to manuals on how to make different poisons and things like that. So they thought he was pretty good for it, but they could never really get any conclusive evidence linking him to the case. And their investigation of Roger Arnold ended up getting thwarted because, again, this has to do with some of the politics involved in this huge case. While they were inventorying their everything they had found in the search, CPD Brass came in and started trying to interview Arnold, and this rapport that these two detectives we interviewed had gotten ruined, and Arnold lawyered up and he stopped talking. So he was released 72 hours later on basically just misdemeanor weapons violations, because they found some unregistered weapons in his home. And so he was released, and he was never charged with the Tylenol case, but his name got leaked to the media pretty quickly, and he became known. It became a national story. Tylenol suspect Roger Arnold, and he claimed that it ruined his life. He was already, going through problems, and he said that he was ostracized in his community and at work, and teenagers drove past his home and threw things at his home. And he said that he became so enraged, he wanted to get it back at the bar owner who he believed dropped the dime and ruined his life, and told police that he could be the Tylenol killer. So a year later, he actually shot an innocent man that he thought was a man who resembled the bar owner, but it wasn't. It ended up being John Stanishaw, a father of three little girls. And we interviewed his youngest child, Lori, and talked about the impact of the crime. Really, John Stanishaw is the eighth victim in this case. And he, was convicted of murder and went to prison and got out and died in it was about 2008.
And of course, the other suspect is James Lewis. Can you talk about him and how he came to police attention?
James Lewis, as James Lewis has a history of doing, inserted himself into this case. He sent a extortion letter to Johnson & Johnson demanding $1 million to stop the killing, and left a bank account a closed bank account of a Chicago travel agency. So when the FBI became the custodians of this letter, they went to the travel agency owner and they asked him, they ruled him out as a suspect, and then said, hey, who knows you that could pull off such a, vile stunt? And he said, well, a man named Robert Richardson. And that was an alias used by James Lewis. They eventually connected. They go on, you talk about the use of media They go on national television the night they identify Robert Richardson. They put his photo up on the screen, and in Kansas City, Missouri, there was a detective watching CBS News with Dan Rather, and he saw the picture and said, "That's Jim Lewis." So he called the FBI, and before Dan Rather was off the air that night, the FBI knew the real name of the extortion letter writer, and that was James Lewis. And the more the FBI learned about James Lewis's past, he was wanted on a credit card scam in Kansas City and had been arrested, though charges were later dropped because of a Miranda violation. He had been arrested for murder in Kansas City. And once they learned those details of his past, he went from sort of opportunist writing an extortion letter to prime suspect in the murders. James Lewis has always denied any responsibility for the Tylenol murders. He had admitted in court, his lawyers did on his behalf, that he wrote the attempted extortion letter, but he has always denied that he was the one responsible for putting cyanide in the capsule. So
it's very important to note that.
In the murder that Stacy mentioned, it was in 1978 in Kansas City, and it was incredibly brutal. It was a dismemberment of an elderly man. James Lewis had been his tax man. He had done the man's taxes, and the man actually met James Lewis because he was a walker. He would walk in his neighborhood and past Lewis's home where he did his tax services. And at the time, Lewis had a little girl, and you know, he waved to the little girl. We knew someone who told us the story about this, and they just got to talking, and he began doing his taxes. And this man, this elderly man, had some means. He had some money saved up, and Lewis, you know, was charged. There was a $5,000 check that they determined to Lewis from the victim that had been forged. There was also a Lewis's print was found on a pulley that was used to hoist this man's body into his attic, where he was found dismembered. But because of Miranda violations, James Lewis's the murder charge was dropped on the eve of the trial. And we actually interviewed the prosecutor in the case, who's, you know, talked about how the case still haunts him.
You mentioned Lewis's daughter. Can you tell us what happened to her?
Yeah, she was born with Down syndrome. Her name was Toni Ann. And as many children who have Down syndrome, she had a heart defect. And she had a surgery when she was about 3 months old, and another one when she was 5 years old, and she did not survive the surgery. She died of post-surgery complications, including the rupture of the sutures used to repair her heart. And those sutures were manufactured by Proline Ethicon and marketed under the brand name Proline, which was trademarked by Johnson & Johnson.
And of course, they're the manufacturer of a Tylenol.
Yes.
Another important thing to know about James Lewis is when he, as Stacy mentioned, he was wanted for the credit card fraud. He left Kansas City and lived in Chicago for under a year under the alias. And then 3 weeks before the Tylenol poisonings, moved to New York.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
And he's been a focus for quite a while. Can you tell us about the sting operation mounted against him a while back?
Sure. So James Lewis did go to prison for the attempted extortion. He was never charged with the killings, and he got out in about the mid-90s. And then after that, the case was, you know, somewhat dormant. They would do occasionally, you know, send things to the lab for testing, but there was nobody working full-time on the case. And in 2016, a Chicago journalist went to the FBI and said he had been investigating the case for years, and he believed he had solved it. And the special agent in charge of the Chicago office, Robert Grant, his interest was piqued. So he called in one of the FBI agents from the first task force, a man named Roy Lane Jr., and he asked Roy to come in and listen to this journalist explain what his theory was, and Roy did. This was sort of the case that he's a legendary FBI agent in Chicago, and this was the case that he never got to solve, that he never got to close. So he welcomed the opportunity to come back and listen, and the journalist presented a suspect who wasn't James Lewis and wasn't Roger Arnold, but that when it was over, the journalist left, and Robert Grant turned to Roy Lane and said, "Yeah, what do you think?" And Roy said, "That's interesting, but we think we know who did it, and you know, the main suspect is James Lewis." And so that got them thinking that maybe this was, you know, a cold case they should reopen. And they did. And they did so under a sting operation. And this might sound familiar, in which a journalist talks to Roy Lane Jr. and says, "I've solved the case." So Roy Lane calls James Lewis and says, "Hey, this journalist can help you, you know, can help solve the case and maybe clear your name. Are you interested in helping us?" And James Lewis, who has a history of inserting himself in this case, welcomed the opportunity. And he started working unknowingly with Roy Lane Jr. and an undercover agent who went by the name Sherry Nichols.
One interesting thing to know about Roy Lane and James Lewis's history and why Lane would call Lewis and Lewis would know who he is, remember the profiler said that at some point when things start getting quiet, the killer is going to reach out to law enforcement. He's going to identify someone with, who wears a blue suit and a red tie and is like that quintessential all-American, gray-haired law enforcement. So that, but for the gray hair, was Roy Lane in 1983. And Lane had sat through the trial at the prosecutor's table, the attempted extortion trial. So he was a daily presence during that, and Lewis recognized him. And sure enough, after Lewis was convicted of attempted extortion, but before he was sentenced, Lewis reached out to Roy Lane and said, "I'm not the killer, but I bet I can help you figure out who it is." And thus began a half a dozen meetings, which are somewhat infamous in the story, between Roy Lane, the FBI agent, James Lewis, the suspect, and a U.S. assistant attorney named Jeremy Margolis. They met like a half a dozen times and talked about different scenarios. And Lewis, who's a very gifted artist, did the infamous drawings of this is how the killer would have done it. This is how the killer would have transported the cyanide. This is how the killer would have salted the capsules. And they are, they're subjective drawings, but thus, you know, during these meetings, were able to lock Lewis in on some interesting details and timelines about what he was doing at the time that when he mailed the letter and things like that. And he also said a lot of different suspicious things during these meetings, like, Roy Lane, for example, asked him, "Why do you think the killer chose extra strength Tylenol instead of regular strength Tylenol? Do you think he or she was trying to spare a child from being a victim?" And according to Roy Lane, Lewis began hysterically laughing and said, "No, don't you get it? There's something extra in the Tylenol." So either he was enjoying this, you know, cat and mouse game and with law enforcement and just saying, you know, odd things. We don't know.
What was the end result of this sting operation?
So jump forward to 2006. Like Stacey said, they began this 18-month sting operation where they traveled to New York and Chicago and Kansas City, Missouri, to research, you know, going back to James Lewis's early life to research this book. And secretly, they're recording them the entire time. And they get enough what they considered to be evidence and presented to judges in Cook County and Middlesex County in the Cambridge area where Lewis had relocated after he got out of federal prison. And they get judges to give them search warrants. So they're able to do this infamous raid that was national news in 2009, where you saw the FBI agents carrying the banker boxes out of Lewis's condo in 2009. So they later went to court to get his DNA and fingerprints, which they had earlier copies of, but they did it again. We should state that Lewis there's no physical evidence at all, direct physical evidence connecting Lewis to this crime. But so then, you know, that was reported on in 2010, and that was it. You never heard anything after that. There were no charges, and story kind of faded into the background.
Prosecutors were asked to seat a grand jury to get testimony from witnesses. Investigators believed they had a chargeable circumstantial case. But as far as we've been told by sources, one witness out of five requested was called before the grand jury, and that witness took the fifth and didn't answer questions.
So that was the thing that Stacey and I really wanted to figure out when we began our investigation. What did they get during this 18-month undercover sting operation? And why did prosecutors not charge? Did they really have anything? We had heard it was a circumstantial case. And so we really wanted to find out what they had on them, besides the extortion letter, of course, and the odd things he said to Roy Lane and Jeremy Margolis during those meetings.
And you said when you first started working on this, you thought it was a cold case, but you found out things were still happening. Were those things happening involving, they involved Mr. Lewis?
Yes. So Stacey and I began, I believe, in January, and we were able to get a list of about 100 names of people who were the law enforcement who was on Task Force One. And we just we didn't want to assume anything we had read or heard about the case was accurate. We wanted to report it as if the crime happened today or yesterday. So we began calling people. And one of the first people we called, I'm not kidding you, literally one of the first people we called was this long retired suburban police detective who said, oh, my son, Herb Hochberg Jr. is an FBI agent and he's doing stuff on the case now. And our jaws dropped and we realized that they're still working on it. And then we began, making more calls, and we learned that there was a meeting between, there's been this one detective, a suburban detective named Scott Winkleman, who has just made this his passion since 2006, and he's just kept working the case. We found out that he met with top Cook County state's attorney investigators in January, and then there were later meetings this last summer, which culminated in them going out there in late September and interviewing Lewis for several hours, we reported. So yeah, he's still the target, and he's been the target for decades.
I wanted to take some time to leave Chicago and go to New York for a second, because I'm from a town called Bronxville, New York. And so I've always been very interested in this case, because the grocery shop where I grew up going to across from my church had some sort of Tylenol or some sort of similar poisoning a few years after the Chicago poisoning.
1986, yeah.
Yeah.
So your grocery store was the AMP then.
Yep, it would go back and forth between AMP and Food Emporium when I was there, but it was the same building, same structure.
Same building.
And so, that was Diane Ellsworth.
Ellsworth.
Yeah. I was wondering if you could talk a bit about that and if you came upon anything about that in your investigation.
So yeah, so, you know, when we talk about legacies of the 1982 case, you know, one of the main ones is all the safety seals that we see on bottles today, on everything from the milk and peanut butter Christy mentioned to our medicine. And those safety seals were in place in 1986 when a woman was visiting her boyfriend's parents and in suburban New York, and she took a Tylenol before going to bed. Her boyfriend had gone downstairs, opened a new bottle, and brought her a couple capsules of extra strength Tylenol. And when she didn't come up downstairs in the morning, they went to the room where she was sleeping, and they found her dead. And it turned out that she had taken Tylenol filled with cyanide. And there was another bottle found in the area filled with cyanide. And the question was, okay, how did this happen? If we're supposed to have these safety seals, James Lewis, their prime suspect, well, he's in prison, how does this fit into sort of their working theory of what happened in 1982? We talked to a retired police detective who investigated that case, and he told us that both the FBI and his department believe the bottles were still tampered on the shelf level, though they didn't entirely rule out the production line like the 1982 task force did. But they believe it happened on the shelves, and they believe that the bottles were tampered through the bottom, actually, and then put back in the box and resealed. And the detective we spoke with said, you know, they would practice, you know, tampering through the bottom of the bottle in their police station, and actually got quite good at it to the point where you really couldn't see the tampering that had been done. So to this day, the victim, Diane Ellsworth, her father was a state trooper in New York, and her boyfriend and the family were, you know, questioned for hours. They were considered suspects. They were eventually cleared. And to this day, no one has ever been charged with her death. It remains an open case. But what it did do is Johnson & Johnson got rid of the capsule form, because you used to be able to pull it apart, pour out the acetaminophen, put in whatever you want, you know, put it back in. So they got rid of it and went to the sort of the gel capsules that, you know, or the caplets that we know today. And that began, you know, another sort of tragic legacy of this case.
And we should, go ahead.
We should note that James Lewis was in federal prison for the attempted extortion charge at the time.
And much like, though, the James Lewis situation, there was somebody who sort of inserted themselves into the investigation in the man named DeWitt Gilmore, who wrote a letter claiming responsibility, but yeah.
Yes, and they talked to him, and I think they decided very quickly that, and there were a couple of suspects in the 1982 case, just suddenly decided very quickly could not have pulled it off, like wasn't savvy enough or organized enough to actually do what he claimed, and that he was just an opportunist.
And that's what they thought about James Lewis as well in 1982 when they got the extortion letter demanding $1 million to stop the killing. Then they learned about his past, the murder charge that he had been charged with, but, you know, was dropped on the eve of trial, the other case with the credit card fraud. And that's, at first they thought it was just a hoax, but then they realized they wanted to look deeper into his background, given the history of violence that they had dug up on him.
It's really a fascinating story full of twists and turns, and anyone interested in getting a lot more detail should absolutely read your articles in the Tribune and or listen to the podcast, which also includes the story of when you guys tracked down Lewis and were actually able to talk briefly with him. It's a great podcast.
Can I just ask you one thing before we go? Can you talk through a bit of what, I mean, the amount of work that goes into putting together a podcast and a series of articles like this. Can you just maybe talk about some of your process of really just really shining such a spotlight on this case?
We traveled to 7 states, went to Boston twice to interview Lewis, or tried to interview Lewis. He talked so much in the early years of this case, but for the last 15 years, it's been hasn't been photographed, hadn't given any major interviews since 2010. So he had ignored our letters and attempts to reach him beforehand. So we went there twice. We interviewed more than 150 people. We filed dozens of Freedom of Information Act requests, open records requests. It was really a labor of love. We wanted to be very, very sensitive with the victims' families. They had been so traumatized, and sadly there were, because it was such a national story, they had dealt with some bad actors in the media back in the day, people just, you know, camping out on their lawns and things like that. So we decided the best way to approach them, we thought about how we'd want to be approached, was a handwritten letter. So we wrote letters to each of the victims' families rather than just showing up on their doorstep or cold calling on a, you know, Saturday afternoon. And we accepted their refusal. If they said, you know, I've been down this path too many times, and rather than badgering them, and we went on to the best friend or the bridesmaid or the coworker or the neighbor, things like that, because we really wanted, rather than just focusing on how these poor souls died, we wanted to say how they lived. They were truly amazing, innocent human beings. And that the world was deprived of some wonderful people. So that was challenging. We also did a lot of source work. We were able to see undercover FBI video from the sting, which, you know, that doesn't happen a lot, right? Right, Anya, in reporting career. So that was a pretty aha moment for us of some of the things that Lewis said. And so it was a real journey.
Awesome. Well, this was tremendous. Is there anything we didn't ask you about that you think it's important to mention about this story or your process or anything that people should know going into this? It's one of those, I mean, we talk about this sometimes, these crimes that seem really complicated, but are ultimately relatively simple. And then in this case, it's very much a sprawling case, it sounds like.
You know, there's so much talk, and Christy alluded to sort of our approach to the victims, and there is so much talk today about making sure you're mindful of the victims when covering crime. And I am proud that we met the victims where they're at, but also had each victim represented by someone who loved them in the podcast and in the print piece, and someone who remembered them and someone who still cares whether this case is solved or closed or what the status of the case is. So there are people out there who still want answers for deeply personal reasons.
You know, you mentioned it's still a hot case, you know, hotter than anyone realized before you started looking into it. Can we expect future coverage from you?
Absolutely. We're going to stay on the story. We know that the day we launched, the investigators went to Boston, and they were able to convince Lewis without an attorney during a taped interview to sit and talk to them at a hotel near his home in Cambridge, and they talked for several hours. We know that they returned, and we know that there's going to be another joint meeting soon between basically the people are meeting are Cook County prosecutors, DuPage County prosecutors, and then Arlington Heights Police, and then there's still some FBI involvement. But really, the ball is in prosecutor's court. You know, we've been told that they have a circumstantial case against James Lewis. It's not going to get better with time. This is as good as it gets. So we don't know what he said during that most recent interview. He hasn't been charged with anything, so that tells us something, right? But we plan to continue our coverage and if there's any new developments.
We want to thank Christy and Stacy for taking the time to talk with us.
We highly recommend their podcast on the case, Unsealed. It goes into quite a bit more detail than we had a chance to get into here today, and it is well worth a listen. Thanks so much for listening to The Murder Sheet. If you have a tip concerning one of the cases we cover, please email us at murdersheet@gmail.com. If you have actionable information about an unsolved crime, please report it to the appropriate authorities.
If you're interested in joining our Patreon, that's available at www.patreon.com/murdersheet. If you want to tip us a bit of money for records requests, you can do so at www.buymeacoffee.com/murdersheet. We very much appreciate any support.
Special thanks to Kevin Tyler Greenlee, who composed the music for The Murder Sheet, and who you can find on the web at kevintg.com.
If you're looking to talk with other listeners about a case we've covered, you can join the Murder Sheet discussion group on Facebook. We mostly focus our time on research and reporting, so we're not on social media much. We do try to check our email account, but we ask for patience as we often receive a lot of messages. Thanks again for listening.